Chapter 2. To the eyes of a man viewing it from behind, the nut-brown hair was a wonder and a mystery. Under the black beaver hat, surmounted by its tuft of black feathers, the long locks, braided and twisted and coiled like the rushes of a basket, composed a rare, if somewhat barbaric, example of ingenious art. One could understand such weavings and coilings being wrought to last intact for a year, or even a calendar month, but that they should be all demolished regularly at bedtime, after a single day of permanence, seemed a reckless waste of successful fabrication. And S.E. had done it all herself, poor thing. S.E. had no maid, and it was almost the only accomplishment she could boast of. Hence the unstinted pains. She was a young invalid lady, not so very much of an invalid, sitting in a wheelchair, which had been pulled up in the front part of a green enclosure, close to a bandstand, where a concert was going on, during a warm June afternoon. It had place in one of the minor parks, or private gardens that are to be found in the suburbs of London, and was the effort of a local association, to raise money for some charity. There are worlds within worlds, in the great city, and though nobody outside the immediate district had ever heard of the charity, or the band, or the garden, the enclosure was filled with an interested audience sufficiently informed on all these. As the strains proceeded, many of the listeners observed the chaired lady, whose back hair, by reason of her prominent position, so challenged inspection. Her face was not easily discernible, but the aforesaid cunning tress weavings, the white ear and poll, and the curve of a cheek which was neither flaccid nor sallow, were signals that led to the expectation of good beauty in front. Such expectations are not infrequently disappointed, as soon as the disclosure comes, and in the present case, when the lady, by a turn of the head, at length revealed herself, she was not so handsome as the people behind her had supposed, and even hoped they did not know why. For one thing, alas, the commonness of this complaint, she was less young than they had fancied her to be. Yet attractive her face unquestionably was, and not at all sickly. The revelation of its details came each time she turned to talk to a boy of 12 or 13 who stood beside her, and the shape of whose hat and jacket implied that he belonged to a well-known public school. The immediate bystanders could hear that he called her mother. Apostrophe, apostrophe, when the end of the recital was reached, and the audience withdrew, many chose to find their way out by passing at her elbow. Almost all turned their heads to take a full and near look at the interesting woman, who remained stationary in the chair till the way should be clear enough for her to be wheeled out without obstruction. As if she expected their glances, and did not mind gratifying their curiosity, she met the eyes of several of her observers by lifting her own, showing these to be soft, brown, and affectionate orbs, a little plaintive in their regard. She was conducted out of the gardens, and passed along the pavement till she disappeared from view, the schoolboy walking beside her. To inquiries made by some persons who watched her away, the answer came that she was the second wife of the incumbent of a neighboring parish, and that she was lame. She was generally believed to be a woman with a story, an innocent one, but a story of some sort or other. In conversing with her on their way home, the boy who walked at her elbow said that he hoped his father had not missed them. "He have been so comfortable these last few hours, that I am sure he cannot have missed us," apostrophe, she replied. "Has, dear mother, not have?" apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed the public schoolboy, with an impatient fastidiousness that was almost harsh. "Surely you know that by this time?" apostrophe, apostrophe, his mother hastily adopted the correction, and did not resent his making it, or retaliate, as she might well have done, by bidding him to wipe that crummy mouth of his, whose condition had been caused by surreptitious attempts to eat a piece of cake without taking it out of the pocket wherein it lay concealed. After this, the pretty woman and the boy went onward in silence. that question of grammar bore upon her history, and she fell into reverie, of a somewhat sad kind to all appearance. It might have been assumed that she was wondering if S. he had done wisely in shaping her life as S. he had shaped it, to bring out such a result as this. In a remote nook in North Wessex, 40 miles from London, near the thriving county town of Aldbrickham, there stood a pretty village with its church and parsonage, which she knew well enough, but her son had never seen. It was her native village, Gamed, and the first event bearing upon her present situation had occurred at that place, when she was only a girl of 19. How well she remembered it, that first act in her little tragi comedy, the death of her reverend husband's first wife. It happened on a spring evening, and she who now, and for many years had filled that first wife's place was then parlor maid in the parson's house. When everything had been done that could be done, and the death was announced, as he had gone out in the dusk to visit her parents, who were living in the same village, to tell them the sad news. As she opened the white swing gate, and looked towards the trees which rose westward, shutting out the pale light of the evening sky, she discerned, without much surprise, the figure of a man standing in the hedge, though she roguishly exclaimed as a matter of form, "Oh, Sam, how you frightened me!" He was a young gardener of her acquaintance. She told him the particulars of the late event, and they stood silent, these two young people, in that elevated, calmly philosophic mind which is engendered when a tragedy has happened close at hand, and has not happened to the philosophers themselves, but it had its bearing upon their relations. "And will you stay on now at the vicarage, just the same?" asked he. As he had hardly thought of that. "Oh, yes, I suppose," she said. "Everything will be just as usual, I imagine." He walked beside her towards her mother's. Presently his arm stole round her waist. She gently removed it, but he placed it there again, and she yielded the point. "You see, dear Sophie, you don't know that you will stay on. You may want a home, and I shall be ready to offer one someday, though I may not be ready just yet." "Why, Sam, how can you be so fast? I've never even said I like thee, and it is all your own doing, coming after me." "Still, it is nonsense to say I am not to have a try at you like the rest." He stooped to kiss her a farewell, for they had reached her mother's door. "No, Sam, you shan't." She cried, putting her hand over his mouth. "You ought to be more serious on such a night as this." And she bade him adieu without allowing him to kiss her, or to come indoors. The vicar just left a widower was at this time a man about 40 years of age, of good family, and childless. He had led a secluded existence in this college living, partly because there were no resident landowners, and his loss now intensified his habit of withdrawal from outward observation. He was still less seen than heretofore, kept himself still less in time with the rhythm and racket of the movements called progress in the world without. For many months after his wife's decease the economy of his household remained as before. The cook, the housemaid, the parlor maid, and the man out of doors performed their duties, or left them undone, just as nature prompted them, the vicar knew not which. It was then represented to him that his servants seemed to have nothing to do in his small family of one. He was struck with the truth of this representation, and decided to cut down his establishment. But he was forestalled by Sophie, the parlor maid, who said one evening that she wished to leave him. "And why?" said the parson. "Sam Hobson has asked me to marry him, sir." "Well, do you want to marry?" "Not much. But it would be a home for me. And we have heard that one of us will have to leave." A day or two after she said, I don't want to leave just yet, sir, if you don't wish it. Sam and I have quarreled. Apostrophe, he looked up at her. He had hardly ever observed her before, though he had been frequently conscious of her soft presence in the room. What a kitten-like, flexuous, tender creature she was. She was the only one of the servants with whom he came into immediate and continuous relation. What should he do if Sophie were gone? Sophie did not go, but one of the others did, and things went on quietly again. When Mr. Twycott, the vicar, was ill, Sophie brought up his meals to him, and as he had no sooner left the room one day than he heard a noise on the stairs. As he had slipped down with the tray, and so twisted her foot, that she could not stand. The village surgeon was called in. The vicar got better, but Sophie was incapacitated for a long time, and she was informed that she must never again walk much, or engage in any occupation which required her to stand long on her feet. As soon as she was comparatively well, she spoke to him alone. Since she was forbidden to walk and bustle about, and, indeed, could not do so, it became her duty to leave. She could very well work at something sitting down, and as he had an and a seamstress. The parson had been very greatly moved by what as he had suffered on his account, and he exclaimed, "No, Sophie, lame or not lame, I cannot let you go. You must never leave me again." Apostrophe, he came close to her, and, though she could never exactly tell how it happened, she became conscious of his lips upon her cheek. He then asked her to marry him. Sophie did not exactly love him, but as he had a respect for him which almost amounted to veneration. Even if she had wished to get away from him, she hardly dared refuse a personage so reverend and august in her eyes, and she assented forthwith to be his wife. Thus it happened that one fine morning, when the doors of the church were naturally open for ventilation, and the singing birds fluttered in and alighted on the tie beams of the roof, there was a marriage service at the communion rails, which hardly a soul knew of. The parson and a neighboring curate had entered at one door, and Sophie at another, followed by two necessary persons, whereupon in a short time there emerged a newly made husband and wife. Mr. Twycott knew perfectly well that he had committed social suicide by this step, despite Sophie's spotless character, and he had taken his measures accordingly. An exchange of livings had been arranged with an acquaintance who was incumbent of a church in the south of London, and as soon as possible the couple removed thither, abandoning their pretty country home, with trees and shrubs and glebe, for a narrow, moldy house in a long, straight street, and their fine peal of bells for the wretchedest one-tongued clangor that ever tortured mortal ears. It was all on her account. They were, however, away from everyone who had known her former position, and also under less observation from without than they would have had to put up with in any country parish. Sophie the woman was as charming a partner as a man could possess, though Sophie the lady had her deficiencies. She showed a natural aptitude for little domestic refinements, so far as related to things and manners, but in what is called culture she was less intuitive. As he had now been married more than 14 years, and her husband had taken much trouble with her education, but she still held confused ideas on the use of was and were, apostrophe which did not beget a respect for her among the few acquaintances she made. Her great grief in this relation was that her only child, on whose education no expense had been and would be spared, was now old enough to perceive these deficiencies in his mother, and not only to see them, but to feel irritated at their existence. Thus she lived on in the city, and wasted hours in braiding her beautiful hair, till her once apple cheeks waned to pink of the very faintest. Her foot had never regained its natural strength after the accident, and she was mostly obliged to avoid walking altogether. Her husband had grown to like London for its freedom and its domestic privacy, but he was 20 years his Sophie's senior, and had latterly been seized with a serious illness. On this day, however, he had seemed to be well enough to justify her accompanying her son Randolph to the concert. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.